The National Broadcasting Company presents transcribed The American Form of the Air, founded 22 years ago by Theodore Granick and dedicated to the full and public discussion of all sides of all issues, coming to you from Washington, D.C. Now, here is your moderator, Theodore Granick.
Boom is busting out all over, according to Business Week. The magazine reports that 1950 is now matching or beating boom year 1948 in industrial production, construction, and employment. But a few days ago, the president of the Southern California Edison Company, W.C. Mullendore, said, and I quote, "The country is in the most dangerous and unsound boom in its history. So we ask, where is our economy headed? Is inflation or deflation or stability the next step? What about unemployment? Are business profits too high, or are taxes too high to enable business to go ahead? Do we need a balanced budget? Will prices run away again?" These are some of the questions everybody is asking, because the whole world is affected by the American economy. So today, the American Forum of the Air has invited two distinguished public leaders to give us some of the answers. Senator Owen Booster, Republican of Maine, chairman of the Senate Republican Campaign Committee, and Leon H. Keisling, chairman of the President's Council of Economic Advisers. Now, Mr. Keisling, what do you think of Mr. Mullendore's charge?
I don't know, Mr. Mullendore, Mr. Granick. He may be a very thoughtful gentleman. I don't want to comment on his views since I don't know the man and really don't know what his views are. I do know that the Southern California Edison is doing well. I do know that that great part of the country in which it is located is doing well. And I do know that the whole country is doing well. We have very high employment. Unemployment has dropped to 3 million, which is low for a great country like ours. I'd like to see it drop a little lower. Production and business activity are higher than at any other time on record, including even 1948. And as I go around the country and have talked to scores or hundreds of businessmen, I find that they feel that we are on a basis of stable prosperity and that we're likely to go ahead for another year or two with high and increasing levels, not of prices, but of fundamental business activity and employment and rising standards of living.
Senator Brewster?
Well, I don't like to be in the role of the devil's advocate here to question Mr. Keisling's optimism, and I have great respect for his specialty in economics. He is the chief economic advisor of the government now, and I'm certain all Americans hope, if they do not expect, that the present level of business activity will continue and will increase. But there are some symptoms that make some of us a little uneasy. Mr. Keisling, in some of his pronouncements, sounds almost like the gentleman who said there was going to be a chicken in every pot and two automobiles in every garage. As I read the other day that the stock market was up to the level of 1930, and they thought it would pretty soon reach 1929. Now, those were a little disquieting. Mr. Keisling has pointed out that through the depression of the 30s, government expenditures were not able to solve the problem. I think we're greatly indebted to him for his honest expression of that view in an administration which has been dedicated a great deal to government expenditures to take care of activity. He pointed out, I recall in one of the articles he wrote recently, that it was not until the advent of the defense program of 1940 that we really began to recover from the depression of the 30s. We're now in a sort of Cold War. We're spending an awful lot of money, as he knows.
Want to comment on that, Mr. Keisling?
Well, to comment humorously, I would say that we had an awful big job getting out of an awful big depression, which occurred during the time of the gentleman who was going to put two cars in every garage. More seriously, though, I'm glad the senator, for whom I have high respect, has pointed up the fact that one of the virtues of the American form of government is that even those associated with an administration are self-critical, are trying to do an even better job, are profiting by the mistakes of the past, and we've all made plenty of mistakes in the past. What we want to do now is to get business and Congress and workers and the administration to try not to make those mistakes again, to do a still better job.
Do you feel, Mr. Keisling, that we are in an inflationary period now?
I don't think that we're in an inflationary period anything like the inflationary period in danger that we faced between 1946 and 1948.
Now, how do you distinguish the two periods? We're up, isn't our index somewhat above then?
Well, the index of production is above then, but we've got to distinguish between growth of the economy and increases in prices. Now, the way I would distinguish is this, that between 1946 and 1948, the total level of demand, which resulted from wartime savings and resulted from the fact that the war was financed by borrowing and resulted from the bottlenecks in industrial production, the total demand for goods and services was much higher than what the American economy could produce. And so we had great inflationary pressures. Now, that is not the situation now. The demand is high, incomes are high, employment is high, but productive capacity is much greater. There are great increases in productive capacity. The labor force was terribly strained in 1946. There weren't enough people to fill the jobs. Unemployment, as I've said now, while much lower than it was a few months ago, is a little bit on the high side. You haven't got the strain on the labor force that you had in 1946. And you haven't got the strain on our factories and our mines and our mills. Overall, because productivity, due to the genius of the American business system, has increased so much in these few years.
I think you will recognize, Mr. Keiserling, that some of this, in the minds of many thoughtful observers, and I think many economists, is associated with the very great inflation of various forms of government credit, both in the unbalanced budget of some $5 billion, in the expenditures we're making for foreign countries, in the defense expenditures running around $18 billion, in the enormous credit made available for building houses, and in the consumer credit for buying automobiles and so on, all of which have contributed very greatly to this stimulation and are not susceptible of indefinite continuance in the thought of many. During a war, we stimulate our productive capacity enormously. After the war, we continue it to refill the pipelines, as you say. Then we begin to get into a period when the more permanent aspects, the houses and other things, begin to catch up, and then we get this slump. Now, do you anticipate that we can avoid what has been the unbroken pattern following every great world war convulsion?
I think we've got to avoid the pattern that has been unbroken after every great world war convulsion.
The whole world
after every previous great war has sunk gradually into a great depression and then has moved into another world war.
Yes.
Now, I think that not only the hope but the reasonable expectation that we can so handle our economic affairs that that pattern will not be repeated must be the wish and the purpose and the expectation almost of every citizen, just as we hope and expect and work toward avoiding a third world war. And I think there's a close connection between avoiding a third depression and avoiding a third war. Now you say how? I think we have some evidence on that. I always like to apply a practical test. Now, we had a big recession, really a depression, which started a year and a half after World War I. It started in 1920. Now we've gone 5 years since World War II and we haven't had it. We had a small recession in 1949, but we overcame it fairly rapidly. And applying a practical test, I'm perfectly willing to say that this increase in the range of public understanding, this increase and improvement in business policies, and this increase and breadth in the range of government policies, which I believe are focused primarily upon the welfare of the people and the creation of a healthier economy, were put to a very important test in 1949 and seem on the basis of practical experience to have done a good deal in curtailing the recession and bringing us back to a period of renewed growth much more rapidly and much more surely than in any previous post-war period.
Senator Brewster.
Well, I have here a chart which I don't suppose our audience can see very clearly, but it is a chart. I'll hand you a copy of it. You may be familiar with it, Mr. Keiserling. It is a chart which shows the course of commodity prices after the Napoleonic Wars, the Civil War, the First World War, and the course up to the present time in this war. And the pattern is extremely amazing, as it shows how they go up to their peak and then gradually level off. And while sometimes the decline is more sharp following than before, in general, this shows, and I was interested in what you said about the years, this shows that in about 13 years, it has leveled off, in each instance heretofore. Now, we do see, we have seen a substantial decline in commodity prices, and then we've seen a sudden recovery here. As I recall, it went down a year ago to about 155, and it's now up around 170. Is that approximately the figures?
That's a over-accentuation. Which price level are you speaking of? The wholesale prices?
This is the wholesale price level.
Retail prices?
The wholesale price level.
The wholesale price level has started to move upward since a few months ago.
Yes. Now, what do you attribute that to, and where is it? What's the significance of it?
Well, I think the way our economy works, that prices are falling generally when business activity is falling, and that you may have some price rises in the beginning of a business recovery. And we've had that in the beginning of this business recovery. The whole question is whether the price rises will continue to the point and expand to the point where they puncture the recovery through inflation and carry us downhill again.
You feel very confident that there's no danger of that at this time, I gather.
I feel very confident as to the next few months and as to the beginning of next year. What happens after that will depend, of course, upon the policies that business follows in the meantime, upon the policies that government follows in the meantime.
Which is more important?
I think both are immensely important.
Well, haven't you said repeatedly that business occupies about three-quarters of the economic cycle and government the other quarter, so that the policies of business are the most important single factor in the recovery that we desire and in the progress we desire.
Well, I've said that to accentuate the point that we all believe in a private enterprise economy, that we don't want the government to move from where it is now to the point where it occupies more and more of the picture.
Well,
I think the Senator and I would be in agreement on that.
You don't agree then, apparently, with the policies of your distinguished chief, who we're taking about $40 billion a year now in taxes, you know, and President Truman has proposed programs which should take about $25 billion more, according to the estimate of the Democratic Chairman Expenditures Committee. That would be up to around $65 or $70 billion. I gather you do not feel that would be a constructive step if you don't want government to take more of the productivity of this country.
I don't think it's constructive to unintentionally misunderstand those figures. I think it's always constructive to shed light upon the figures. Now, the figures which you are given are the estimates of what certain basic programs of education, of health, of resource development would amount to 10 years from now.
No, not 10 years.
Oh, yes, those $25 billion figures which I saw repeated in Look magazine just last week are the computations of what they would be in 10 years from now. Now,
I don't agree with you, but that's all I'll say.
Well, I'm rather familiar with those figures, Senator. Those are the figures, an estimation of what these things would cost 10 years from now if they were all carried out and expanded. In the first place, there are certain defects in the figures. The figure is somewhat less than $25 billion, but that's not the main point. Let's say it is $25 billion. The main point is that 10 years from now, if we have a healthy and growing economy, and I don't think we can have a healthy and growing economy without a recognition of business responsibility and of government responsibility. If we have that, we have to set the figures on public cost 10 years from now against the likely size of our economy 10 years from now. In other words, all through our history, we don't compare government expenditures for education now with government expenditures 10 years ago or 20 years ago or 50 years ago or for roads or for anything else. Now, I have confidence enough in the economy to believe that through our business efforts and our government efforts, we're going to continue to grow. We've grown by $10 billion in the last year in our national output. I think
well,
10
now,
years...
Well, just a minute. I think when you're using figures, we hear a great deal about this $250 billion national income with which the people have been very greatly impressed. Isn't it a fact that the dollar you're talking about is one half of what the dollar was 15 years ago, and one-third of what the dollar was in 1900. And when you talk about this $300 billion national income, I suggest we make it $400 billion, which we can by the same simple device by which you devalued the dollar before. In other words, simply talking in these glittering terms of billions means nothing unless the man can buy more than he could before.
Senator, talking about figures means nothing unless the figures are understood and correctly misrepresented. It means a great deal when they are correctly represented. Now, it is true that after this war, as after all wars, we've had a price rise. I think the record will show who did most to try to control that inflation and who did most to try to set aside the measures which would control it. Be that as it may, and not talking about spilt milk, when you adjust for changes in the price level, when you use a uniform $19.49 dollar, the fact still remains that in a uniform dollar on total national output or total national production was $160 billion in 1939, the last year before the war, and $270 billion now. In other words, there has been tremendous real progress, and anybody who knows about American standards of living and about general conditions of life and about general incomes, even as related to prices, knows that the standard of living is immensely higher than before the war.
Well, isn't it true that throughout 175 years, the American standards of living have gone steadily ahead, that it is not peculiar to the period either of the war or of the Depression of the 30s or any other period? Hasn't there been approximately 3% increase in our national product over a long period of years?
On the average, but they haven't gone steadily ahead. They've been interrupted from time to time
and devastated
millions of families through depressions.
Yes.
Now, I think if we have a fairly stable economy and that we can go ahead fairly steadily in the estimates of a $300 billion national income, just to answer the point you raised, within 5 years, is not based upon price rises, but is merely based upon genuine national growth at the average rate that we have attained before the war
and
periods of stable
prosperity. Is that going to be by continuing a $5 or $6 billion deficit each year in government spending and an increase of the government debt from its present $257 billion level?
Very much on the contrary. If the national income grows from year to year, even at current taxes, and I'd like to see taxes reduced when they can be, but even at current taxes, if the national income increases from year to year, we'll have a surplus within a year or a year and a half. As a matter of fact, the deficit was caused mostly by two things. First, at least in my judgment, the premature and excessive tax reduction of $5 or $6 billion at the peak of inflation in 1948.
Well, what about
which
now?
The president
just a moment.
Three times
just a
vetoed,
moment. Just a moment.
Let's answer that. Go ahead, Senator.
Do you think that the president's bill on tax reduction, when he took $4 billion off from the 250 richest corporations in this country in the removal of the excess profits tax, had anything to do with that? That was the Truman bill. The other bill you speak of, the tax reduction bill, took 7 million Americans entirely off the tax rolls and gave 60% of that reduction, which you seem to criticize, to people with incomes under $5,000 a year. Which kind of a tax reduction bill do you, as the economic advisor of the president, recommend?
As to the removal of the excise profits tax right after the war, the excess profits tax right after the war, the president, unlike some other people, admits mistakes of judgment from time to time and has said from time to time that that tax was removed too soon.
Well, that was his bill at any rate, and that's what he signed.
But we don't want to cry too much over spilt milk. Let's look ahead as to what we should do now. Do you think taxes should be reduced now?
Do you want to answer that before I take a question? Go ahead, Senator.
Yes, I do. And I also believe that expenditures should be reduced, and the only time that the budget has been balanced and expenditures have been reduced was under the Republican 80th Congress. And that's the only hope of the American people, that they'll ever get a budget in balance and ever get their taxes soundly reduced.
Gentlemen, let me take a question from a lady in the audience. Go ahead, ma'am, please.
Senator Brewster, do you think Truman's suggestion of the 35-hour week is a good move toward stable economy?
I think that we are probably going to need to buckle up our belts. If the situation in this world is as dangerous as many think, and I'm not disposed to minimize it, I think very shortly the American people have got to decide between guns and butter, between work and waste, between welfare and warfare. I think if we've got to have $15 or $20 billion spent for defense, it obviously means we've got to tighten up our belt elsewhere, and that Americans have got to return in some measure to the habits of work and thrift and devotion which have enabled us to get ahead so far.
Mr. Keisling.
Well, the senator says that if we need $20 billion for defense, we should have it, and that would be about $7 billion above the current level.
Yes, and we could do away with the...
At the same time, you want to reduce taxes, and I'd like you to specify where you're going to take $7 billion out of the current budget.
I'm going to take it
out. Most of it is in fixed charges for the course of the past
war. That is an absolutely false statement.
Where would the $7 billion come from?
I went through, in the first place, the balancement of budget after the First World War under a New England Yankee who knew how to balance budgets. And it was a very simple process by simply holding down appropriations as much as we could and then each year taking 10% out of our expenditures for personnel and other matters, and very shortly we had the budget balanced and we retired the national debt, some 40-50% of it. And it is by that same simple process, unknown to many of our economists and present government bureaucrats, that the process alone can be done. That was what we did in 1948 and 47, and that's what we've got to do again. And the sooner we start to do it, the better. Now, you speak about defense. I believe the defense of this country is a primary responsibility, and I do not believe the American people have got to be bribed by government handouts in order to compensate them for that. I think the tears and sweat and blood of Churchill, if the communists are threatening us, is what this American people have got to get ready to think about and not listen to the siren song of those who think that we can go ahead and build up a national budget to $75 or $100 billion and not go to an inevitable bust.
Well, that's a fine peroration, Senator, but it doesn't answer the question as to where $7 billion can be taken out of the current budget.
You can't take
$7 billion out of the current budget by homilies about Mr. Andrew Mellon's tax policies. Maybe they were good and maybe they were bad. But in the current budget of $41 billion, as you know, a very large part of it is made up of fixed interest payments on the debts created by the last war, of payments to veterans who suffered in the last war, and things of that kind. And a large part of it is made up of national defense and of the foreign aid and assistance programs. Now, where is the $7 billion coming from? That's
it's
a very
exactly
simple question.
Where, out of the $6 billion, not in defense expenditures, but in domestic expenditures, by which our budget has been increased in the last 3 years under the leadership of Mr. Truman.
Well, then you feel that the increase in expenditures...
Now, that wasn't any of the items you speak of at all.
You feel that increase in expenditures, let us say, for health, for the support of farm income... should be decreased by $7 billion out of the $6 billion increase that has taken place in the
those
past few years?
Those were not for that purpose, and in my judgment...
Well, what purpose were they for? I'm asking
they
you
were
which one should be reduced.
Very much in the increases with government personnel, which has been held at the enormous heights to which it was achieved during the war. We were running this country in 1939 under Mr. Roosevelt, who was a pretty good spender himself, for something under $10 billion. He took the budget at $5 billion 10 years earlier, and he criticized that very severely, and he said that he would run it for 25% less. That was the pledge of the 1932 platform. By 1939, he'd built it up to $10 billion, and he was still running this government. We had quite a government here. We had quite a country in 1939. Then came the war, which, as you say, cured that depression. I hope that your object is not to have another world war to cure the difficulties which may recur.
Go ahead, Mr. Kaiser.
Well, nobody wants another world war, and if we're going back to read what Mr. Roosevelt said in 30, we can go back to read what Andrew Jackson said. I still haven't heard when the Hoover Commission itself said that if you didn't cut programs, the most you could save on personnel, even if you strapped agencies to the extreme, is $1 or $2 billion. Now, you can't take $7 billion.
$4 billion.
And you're upping him to $6 or $7.
Gentlemen,
no, I'm not upping Mr. Hoover. I am downing many of the people. As you say, Mr. Hoover did not discuss policies.
Gentlemen,
he discussed personnel.
May I take one more question from the audience? Our time is running short. Go ahead, sir.
Mr. Kaiserling, do you honestly and sincerely believe that our economy as it exists today is really sound with a multi-billion-dollar federal debt and continued deficit spending?
In the first place, when I say that the economy is sound, I don't mean that it's perfect. I think it's sounder than it has been before for the basic reason that economic policies have been followed which have distributed the opportunities and the chances to make a living and therefore to spend among wider masses of the people and created a larger base for the prosperity of the economy, and that is the fundamental trend which has gone on over the past 15 or 20 years, and I do believe for that reason that our economy is more sound. But I don't believe it's perfect. I think we've got to adopt a lot of new policies. I think we've got to be thinking and self-critical all the time. But we can't do that by wrangling about what Mr. Roosevelt said in 1932. We can only do that by thinking about what we ought to do now. Now, as to the deficit, nobody thinks that a permanent deficit is sound. We've had a deficit for a year due to a recession and due, at least in my belief, to premature tax reductions in an excessive amount that weren't so generously distributed among the people as the senator seems to think. But be that as it may, I think we should try to cure the deficit as rapidly as possible. I think that by next year or in a year and a half, we will have a balanced budget if we can maintain the prosperous growth of the country along the lines it is now.
I'm sorry, gentlemen, but it's time for summary. Senator Brewster, will you sum up, please?
Well, I was greatly impressed with Mr. Keiserling's observation that we had had an unbalanced budget for the past year. That is certainly correct. We had a balanced budget for a couple of years earlier under Republican Congress, the only time we've had it, in 18 years under this administration, whose policies Mr. Keiserling apparently is now going to direct or advocate. When we've had an unbalanced budget for 18 years under a philosophy that is now in vogue, it occurs to me that with it running at a $5 billion temperature still, there is little hope that the present administration ever will or ever can or ever desires to balance that budget, which is, after all, the only way the American dollar and the American savings and the American people can be guaranteed the stability which Mr. Keiserling and I both agree is most desirable.
Thank you, Senator Brewster. Your summary, Mr. Keiserling, please.
I have the last summary.
You have the summary now, sir.
Well, in the first place, as to the 18-year deficit, let's recognize the fact that over the past 20 years, we've had 5 years of the most enormous war in history, and we had 10 years working our way out of the most terrific depression that ever hit this country, not under the auspices of the current administration. The deficit was occurred first in working our way out of a depression which existed and was ignored for 4 years before this philosophy that the senator refers to came into active effect through the will of the American people. That was the first way in which a deficit was built up, but that didn't build the national debt up very much. What built the national debt up immensely was World War II. And I happen to be one of those who believe that Hitler was responsible for World War II and not any sector of the American people. We went into that war when we were attacked. And of the $250-$200 billion national debt, well over $200 billion of it was caused directly by World War II.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. You have listened to a discussion, Where's Our Economy Headed?